A joint hearing of the Capital Investment Committee and Environment, Finance, and Policy Committees for February 28th is called to order. I just want to welcome Chair Hansen and members of the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee today. Chair Hansen and I thought that it would be helpful to bring the committees together for an overview of PFAS as it relates to our infrastructure. And so with that, I will turn it over to Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Today we're going to hear about the status of the 3M settlement. Although it seems like just a little while ago, it's actually a few years ago, and many members were not here when that occurred. And we're also going to hear about the multi-state settlement, which is more recent, and how other states are addressing PFAS infrastructure. Members, please seek recognition from Chair Lee or myself for questions, and you'll be called upon at the end of each presentation. So let's get started. Welcome Special Assistant Cerdo. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Special Assistant Attorney General Peter Cerdo of AGO's office. In my work at the AGO's office, I'm in the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, and I represent DNR and MPCA, as well as the AGO's interest in the 2018 settlement with 3M, and I also represent MPCA on a variety of other PFAS-related matters. I was asked to come today and give a brief overview of the status of the settlement, which goes back in time, actually all the way into the 80s, and I'll get to that in a moment, as well as what's called a multi-district litigation in the District of South Carolina. That's a federal court process where lawsuits that are brought around the country are pulled into one central location, in this case South Carolina, to be administered as a group because so many of them are alike and have commonalities that can be more efficiently pursued through this MDL process. So backing up a little bit to the history beginning in the 80s, there were several sites in our East Metro area of the Twin Cities where we were aware, at least two of them, there was a problem with VOCs being emitted. These were waste sites where 3M had dumped manufacturing waste. And so beginning in the 80s, these sites were being brought into our environmental programs to address those VOC problems. There was also a waste site in Woodbury where 3M had disposed of its industrial waste and had a variety of pumping stations that were being used to bring up groundwater. That groundwater was used in their industrial processes and then being discharged into the Mississippi. Starting in the early aughts, around 2002, we were beginning to see PFOA and PFOS, which are two of what I'll call the legacy long-chain PFAS analytes, coming out of those sites and being detected in the groundwater. So that kicked off a request, or actually specifically a MERLA work, that's Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act, where 3M stepped up to do a lot of work to assess those sites and figure out what was going to be needed to address the PFAS that the state was seeing in the groundwater. That work ended up culminating in a 2007 document that we call the SACO, S-A-C-O, for Second Amended Consent Order. That SACO required 3M to do a variety of evaluations and come up with a plan, and it reserved the state's rights to pursue other remedies, most notably NRD, or natural resources damages. Fast forward to 2010, the state filed a lawsuit in the name of the Attorney General, at that time Lori Swanson, as well as the commissioners of DNR and the Pollution Control Agency. And that complaint was a natural resources damages complaint against 3M for the damages of PFAS to the environment in the East Metro. That lawsuit went on for approximately 8 years until 2018. It was settled in February of 2018 on the eve of trial. The settlement amount for that case was $850 million, which I've learned was actually the third largest natural resources damages settlement in the history of the country after the Exxon Valdez oil spill and the Deepwater Horizon blowout. Now, there was a private law firm that the AG's office had retained to represent the state as part of that settlement. We received its fee out of that, but once everything was said and done, the corpus of that grant fund was well over $700 million. So PCA and DNR formed a task force to determine the best ways to implement the grant fund. The way that 2018 settlement was structured was that the dollars provided to the grant fund would be used in a descending order of priorities, the first of which would be to provide for clean drinking water in the East Metro communities affected by those dumps that were releasing PFAS that we were finding in the groundwater. So that first priority is going to end up taking the lion's share of the entirety of that grant fund. I will point out that even at $850 million, that does reflect a settlement amount. It was amount that the parties agreed to exchange to avoid the risks of litigation. And even at the time, it was understood that it might not be enough, or was known to not be enough, given the scope and need that we were going to have to address. Since then, and this is true across the board, we've learned more about PFAS in general. And when I say PFAS, I'm talking about PFAS, which is a categorical term for all of these fluorinated compounds. Our understanding of those is continuing to evolve. The health risks are continuing to become more well-documented. And the levels that humans should be exposed to are continuing to be ratcheted down by both our Department of Health and by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. So while we've been planning to address these things using the grant fund, we are also continuing to be aware that the level to which we need to treat the water to make it fit for human consumption is going to become more and more stringent. So in 2018 through 2021, the joint members of that task force established what MPCA and DNR called the Comprehensive Drinking Water Supply Plan. That's specific to those East Metro communities that need the water treatment to address the PFAS from the dumping activities. That Comprehensive Drinking Water Supply Plan has accounted for or budgeted every dollar of the grant fund and then some to deal with the need to do capital build out, largely filtration or other treatment systems. The primary ways that we deal with PFAS is with activated carbon, reverse osmosis, and ion exchange. And different types of PFAS react differently to different treatment methods, so it gets a little bit complicated. If I tried to go into the details there, I'd get quickly out of my own comfort zone. But these are all things that communities need to look at putting in to address the PFAS that they're seeing in their groundwater systems. In the meantime, even after Minnesota had put its own case to bed, there are a number of public water systems, municipalities, sovereigns like other states, that filed their own lawsuits against not only 3M, but DuPont and a host of additional PFAS manufacturers for PFAS contamination in their own water systems or states. By and large, these cases were all removed to this MDL I referenced at the beginning of my comments in the District of South Carolina. Those cases were originally brought into the MDL because they had claims against what is called AFFF, or aqueous firefighting foam. It's one of the main categories that we see for groundwater contamination of PFAS. Those AFFF cases, as well as cases that went beyond AFFF, were generally being assigned to this court in South Carolina. There are a few exceptions. Maine is one of them, where it was able to keep part of its cases in its own state court system. But in general, just about everything PFAS or PFAS adjacent was getting put into the South Carolina MDL. Now, there's a lot of stuff happening there. One big chunk of it, though, is what I will call the public water systems case. Those public water systems would be independent water systems that are not states or sovereigns and that have the capacity to sue or be sued in their own name. There was, last summer, announced two big settlements involving the DuPont entities and 3M. The DuPont entity settlement was a class action settlement, I can get to that in a second, to the tune of about $1.5 billion. The 3M settlement was also a class settlement that is valued somewhere between $10.5 and $12.5 billion nationwide. Now, the way class action works is it will define the members of the class. There are class representatives that are involved in litigation, but most class members are not party to the case. Instead, the class settlement will define who the beneficiaries are supposed to be. In this case, it was all of these public water systems. And then there's a process by which they will receive notice that they are a class member, and it will give them an opportunity to object to the terms of the settlement or to opt out of being a class member. So once those settlement agreements went out, or were finally approved by the court, the notices went out, the deadlines for the state, sorry, for the public water systems to either stay in or opt out have now passed. I do not have available to me today a list of those public water systems in our state that stayed in the class, that objected, or that opted out. That information is not available to me. I did call the class administrator earlier this week as I was preparing to come and talk with you all, and they said that that information was not available to be shared. I have interfaced somewhat with our League of Minnesota Cities. I know that Craig Johnson is somebody who's deeply involved in their individual decisions. I'm aware anecdotally of some of the municipalities here in the state that might have had concerns and that I suspect did opt out, but I wouldn't be a primary source for that decision. The point is, at this point, the judge overseeing the MDL has approved, finally, the DuPont settlement. And I checked on Monday, and as of February 26, 2024, that court has entered a final order in judgment. So the DuPont settlement is more or less put to bed as to the public water entities that are defined members of the class. The 3M final fairness hearing will be taking place at a hearing on March 1st, 2024. That hearing will also cover what the MDL is going to do with the state claims and the personal injury claims that are still pending in the MDL. So there's a lot of work left to do within that MDL. That's sort of the status of our agreement with 3M. I will point out that our comprehensive drinking water system, comprehensive drinking water supply plan today is well underway. Municipalities that have benefits under it are doing the build out for the capital infrastructure that they need. And that's going to continue. There's no municipality or public water system that has started receiving funds from the class action settlement yet, but they will. 3M, in particular, that's that largest one of $10.5 to $12.5 billion, has 10 years to make payments under that settlement agreement. So it's a relatively long-term payout. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I can update you. I've got you all the way through what's coming up on March 1st, and I'm happy to take questions based on everything I've shared so far.
Attorney General Cerdo, do you think that that list of the opt-ins and the opt-outs will become available? Is that likely that we would be able to see that at some point?
I think so. One of the things that has been happening in that litigation is that the special there's an entity appointed called the claims administrator that's in charge of getting notices out and then collecting up the responses. The docket is full of a bunch of back and forth between that claims administrator, the court, and the parties going through where there might have been errors in the opt-out forms, there might have been missed deadlines, and there could have been other problems. So the administrator was looking for guidance on how to sift through those, and I think that just isn't quite put to bed yet. I also don't know how well done the notice and opt-out process was. I have heard from my counterparts in the state of Connecticut, for example, that the two largest water systems in that state had not received notice of either one of the class action settlements in the first place. So I haven't been able to validate how well covered our public water systems were in terms of even receiving notice. My understanding from League of Minnesota Cities is that it was pretty comprehensive.
Special Assistant, regarding the opt-out and whatnot, you know, once they go through that whole process, Do you know if OBI made public the reasoning why someone may opt out or not?
No, but I will share anecdotally that there was one municipality here in Minnesota that knew it had a price tag of what it thought it needed to build out of about $69 million. This was a municipality that was not initially covered in the comprehensive drinking water supply plan for the grant fund. That $69 million bill was staring them in the face. That municipality went and plugged its well information and contamination information into an estimator that the class action made available. And it's based on the flow rate and the volumes and the types of analytes that they're seeing. That estimator told the municipality that it could expect to receive something like $3.5 or $3.7 million from the class settlement with 3M. So my understanding is that even though there is money available through the class settlement, it is not going to be enough to cover what we think the needs might be. In that particular example, we're talking about 5% of the total need.
And so just to that point real quickly, so is that a 5% cap at the total need? Is there a cap at all, or is it just mostly more going through the estimator and then they will figure it out?
Yes. So to be clear, this $10.5 to $12.5 billion figure is divided up between two tranches of plaintiffs. The first one is public water – I shouldn't say plaintiffs, class members. The first group of class members are those public water systems that have had a detection of PFAS already. The second tranche is public water systems that have not yet discovered that they've got PFAS or detected it, but are required to continue looking for it under an EPA requirement called UMCR5. So we've got those two groups of class members, but nationwide, the dollars that are coming in, the $10.5 to $12.5 billion, is going to be divided up first by paying off the attorney's fees, which is a fee application that the class action attorneys are going to request. There's a few municipalities that are in first place to get their claims paid first, and then everybody else has to split what's left amongst the class members. So it's not a percentage of whatever need is identified. It's what's available from the corpus of that settlement fund.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Chair Hansen.
Attorney General Cerdo, you mentioned the consent order from the early 2000s, and then we have the settlement of 2018. Can you maybe describe the difference? Does the consent order have requirements in addition and above the requirements that are in the settlement?
Yes and no. And I'm sorry to give you a lawyerly answer, but let me just explain what I'm talking about. The SACO from 2007 requires 3M to assess and provide treatment of water for three dump sites, and particularly to get the health value of that water to below what's called an HI of 1. The 2018 grant fund for $850 million is for the dollars that go into the grant fund. The SACO is open-ended in terms of how much money 3M has to spend. The interplay of these was that 2007 SACO was in place under MRLA in 2010 when we filed the NRD complaint and in 2018 when we settled the NRD complaint. So what the 2018 settlement says is we are going to enter into this agreement, we're going to fund the grant fund to the tune of $850 million for 5 years while we're figuring out what we need to do in terms of the capital build out, in terms of O&M, all the information that ends up going into that comprehensive drinking water supply plan. We need time to do that. So for the first 5 years while that's getting figured out, there's a temporary fund of up to $40 million to spend on temporary measures. And we could spend the 5 years on those while those temporary measures are being funded under that separate chunk. After that 5 years, everything that should have been paid for under the SACO is going to be paid for the grant fund. So from 2024, which we are now in, forward, the grant fund is paying for everything, SACO and 2018 settlement. And then once the settlement is fully depleted, the SACO comes back into effect, and 3M still has those obligations.
And follow. So then the SACO, when it comes back, but that only affects the three dump sites that were, and those three dump sites were where?
Oakdale, Cottage Grove, and Woodbury. There's a fourth site that we do have PFAS detection that is related to 3M waste. That's Washington County. That landfill is part of the closed landfill program and is administered by the state.
And then you had mentioned that it was natural resources damages. So with the settlement in 2018, we've learned, since 2018, we've learned a lot more on human health impacts. Is it possible for future liability for 3M to deal with human health impacts rather than natural resources damages?
So the settlement is, this was a natural resources damages complaint. The settlement contains a common clause at the end of it that you would see in just about any settlement agreement called a release. And that's when one party that's entering the settlement agreement says, I'm releasing the other party from certain claims. That release covers not only natural resources damages claims, but also any new claims that might rise under MRLA, statutory authority, common law authority, or any other claim that the state knew of or was unknown as of the date of the settlement agreement. So to answer your question, any new claims that have arisen since February of 2018 are not covered by that release. Any claims that pre-existed February of 2018, I wouldn't want to comment one way or the other as to how those would have to be sorted out.
So just in summary, we have the consent order from 2007, and then we have the 2018 agreement, and now we have DuPont has settled, and we're waiting to see what happens with 3M settlements, and then that may be available for our communities. Some may be available, and some may still choose to litigate for the damages on that on their own.
All of that is correct.
And when we're being asked to fund PFAS remediation for communities, is there any? So how would that come? Let's say with the DuPont settlement, because that's agreed. Let's say hypothetically, the city of Newport has contamination and they were in that settlement. How does that money come if you have X amount of dollars that it would cost and Y amount of dollars that comes from the settlement?
Yes. So if we were going to do it, if we were going to straight line that example I gave of $69 million versus $3.5 million, whatever dollars, and I should point out that the DuPont settlement is 10% of the 3M settlement. So we're not talking about, we're talking about significant dollars, big picture, nationwide. There's a huge, you know, the headline says $12.5 billion, right? That's over 10 years, that's nationwide. You got to divide that out. I'll point out that our settlement in 2018 covered basically one county to the tune of $850 million, right? So I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but it is bad news that there just isn't enough dollars available from the manufacturers of these compounds to cover the need that we now have as a society to deal with the PFAS problem that exists. When this settlement was entered with 3M, one of the main themes from the court, Judge Gergel in South Carolina, as well as the plaintiff's lawyers that were negotiating it, was $10.5 to $12.5 billion was pretty good considering. I think at the time 3M's market cap was $44 billion. And they're all very, very concerned, rightly so, with the potential for bankruptcy. A lot of these same lawyers and law firms had experience in opioid litigation, where there are entities that are still in bankruptcy today for whom states and other plaintiffs have seen not one dime, because that proceeding is tying up their ability to pay. So the calculation that was made for that public water system settlement was that $12.5 billion was a good result to make sure that it was something that 3M could fund and that would be available to public water systems right away, although over 10 years for the total payout. I'll also point out that that doesn't resolve all of the claims that are still pending, including the states and sovereigns that are in that case.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming. So, given your statement about bankruptcy, and I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, and I don't know if you are, but do you know whether this amount would be dischargeable in bankruptcy?
I do not.
Okay. Are you concerned about that?
Yes. It could, right? Right now, the operative theory is that this is an amount that 3M can pay and that it will be able to remain liquid and solvent and to fund. And that was one of the purposes of entering into the settlement that they did in South Carolina.
Thank you, Chair.
So, Special Assistant, being from Minneapolis, when I went through the docket just to look for myself, Minneapolis was listed as an eligible claimant. And I do want to note that when I reached out to Minneapolis, they did mention that as of date, there's no PFAS issue. And so can you just walk through, even though the difference between being an eligible claimant and if these entities actually have PFAS or not, too, just so that members of the public understand what being part of that class action actually mean or whatnot?
So for municipalities that have not yet detected PFAS, but they have to be serving at least, I think, 3,000 individual households. They will continue to get reimbursement from the class fund to monitor for PFAS. Another looming issue that is true of Minneapolis and other public water systems is the extent to which they treat wastewater. There is a concern over the residue that, you know, they've got filtration systems that are going to collect up PFAS. And then the question is, what do we do with that? And is that going to be considered a hazardous waste? And are they going to be able to have some sort of protection as somebody who's a responsible party? That has not been resolved yet out of this class action. But for Minneapolis, it should be able to stay in the class. It should be able to receive the class benefit. And that will be reimbursement for monitoring.
Thank you. Chair Hansen.
So from an infrastructure point, we traveled around the state. We visited many locations. They're asking for PFAS abatement. If we fund state dollars into wastewater or drinking water and there's waste created because of filtration, so that, you're saying that the city may be the responsible party or the state if we're providing the material?
There is currently pending a proposed rule from EPA that has not been finalized that would classify 9 PFAS analytes as hazardous. And so there is a concern there by wastewater treatment systems.
Members, any additional questions? Chair Hansen.
Just to be clear, I think when you receive the opt-out, opt-in information, we'd like that for our committees so we can see what our communities are when you get that.
Of course.
Thank you.
And so thank you, Special Assistant, for coming before us. Right now, we'll transition over to our Zoom testifier so you can leave. Members, I just do want to know, relating to that last piece, if you recall that conversation when we were in Woodbury and how they're dealing with that issue of waste and whatnot, if I recall, 13 truckloads going to the state of Ohio to be burned. And so I think that that's an issue for us to consider as we think about some of these local requests and also the requests from the agencies that we'll be bringing forth before us. So right now we'll turn it over to a Zoom testifier, Gretchen Salter from Safer States. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much. As you said, my name is Gretchen Salter. I'm with Safer States. Can I share my screen for a presentation, or would you prefer I just speak?
Yes, please proceed with sharing your screen.
Thank you.
And members, you do have the handout in your folders too.
Great. So thank you so much for inviting me here today. I am with Safer States. Oops, sorry, my slideshow isn't quite loading. As you see, I have the wheel of death on my screen, so give it a moment. Thank you. Okay, here we are, Gretchen Salter, Safer States. For those who aren't familiar, Safer States is a national alliance of state, local, and national groups working on trying to eliminate toxic chemicals from our environment. But we also track what states are doing on various policies as they relate to toxics. So we've been tracking PFAS policy throughout the country, really since 2017, when the when scientists started sounding the alarm on PFAS as a class. So we started looking to see what states are doing. And so I was asked to testify here today to talk about what states have done regarding PFAS, both on policy and also on infrastructure. So very quickly, it sounds like everybody here knows why we're focused on PFAS, but for those who don't, PFAS are a class of over 15,000 different compounds. Scientists started noticing that PFAS was contaminating a number of different sites, number of different drinking water sites around the country. Right now, the most recent investigation we have has found over 3,000 contaminated water sites around the country. It's estimated that more than 200 million Americans have PFAS in their drinking water systems. I want to point out right now that this map that we're looking at really is only looking at water. It's not looking at sludge, which we see is a massive source of contamination. It's not looking at soil. It's not looking at air. This is really just drinking water. The CDC has estimated that 99% of Americans have PFAS in our blood, and PFAS are found all over the globe. They travel on air currents, and they have been found in the Arctic. In fact, a recent study found over 60 tons of PFAS are in the Arctic. The reason we're concerned about PFAS, as has been stated before, there are a number of different human health outcomes linked to PFAS exposure, including cancer, birth defects, infertility, pregnancy complications, mostly preeclampsia, and a decreased immune response. And the more scientists look at PFAS and its effect on human health, the more they find. So this is really just a snapshot of what PFAS can do. They are called forever chemicals because they don't disappear in the environment. They do not have the ability to break down in the environment on their own. And they can transform, but they stay there forever, and they stay there forever in us. So starting in 2017, states have really been leading the way on PFAS. Thus far, we have 28 states that have adopted PFAS policies. They include things from water to restrictions on PFAS in consumer products and accountability. So here's a map of states that have taken action on PFAS. The big product categories that have been regulated in PFAS include food packaging. So that includes both paper-based food packaging as well as plastic food packaging, because we've now learned that PFAS can be used to make plastics. Eight states have adopted restrictions on PFAS in carpets and rugs and aftermarket treatments. So, you know, when you used to shop for that stain-resistant carpet, it was PFAS that caused that stain resistancy. And so eight states have now banned the use of PFAS in those applications. Six states have taken action on PFAS in cosmetics. Cosmetics in this case also includes personal care products. There was a new study out today showing that several types of deodorant contain PFAS, and those states that have passed legislation on PFAS, it would cover deodorants and soaps and other types of personal care products. And 12 states have banned the sale of PFAS that can PFAS and firefighting foam. And it's really those states that have led the way that are that's the reason that we're seeing a number of different fluorine-free foams hitting the market right now. The Department of Defense and their military specification has said that they will no longer use AFFF foam, and a number of airports are transitioning away from AFFF foam now that the FAA has come out with a fluorine-free foam that is allowed to be used. So that transitioning is now happening over time. States are also leading the way on PFAS and water standards. The previous speaker spoke about the new EPA proposed MCL for six different types of PFAS at 4 parts per trillion. But prior to that, we had 10 states who adopted some enforceable drinking water standards for certain PFAS. Delaware and Virginia are still developing. And 13 additional states, including Minnesota, adopted guidance levels or notification levels for PFAS in drinking water. As our previous speaker talked about, it's usually carbon filtration systems or other type of filtration systems, but a big question that states are trying to grapple with is what to do with those filtration systems and those carbon filters once they have been spent, once they are full. And the truth is we don't really have a good answer. A lot of times PFAS have been incinerated, and that's really why we're seeing PFAS migrate to the poles. They travel on air currents. Traditional incineration cannot destroy PFAS in the way it needs to be destroyed. There have been a number of different pilot projects to try to find ways to destroy PFAS that have been pretty promising, but so far they have not been at scale. And so a lot of states are just storing the filters until they can find a way to actually destroy PFAS. And so that's the situation that is going to quickly become untenable. States are also leading the way on PFAS accountability, and Minnesota really is at the forefront of leading the way on PFAS accountability. Currently, we have 29 state AGs who have pursued litigation against manufacturers of PFAS chemicals for contaminating water supplies and other natural resources. And the reason is a good one. As you heard from the previous speaker, billions of dollars are going to be spent in the next decade to try to remediate drinking water soil, groundwater from PFAS contamination. It's an unfortunate situation that the more we look for PFAS, the more we find. And getting PFAS out of water is not easy. It requires a lot of times new filtration systems to be built, entirely new systems to be put online. And so it's an expensive proposition to try to treat PFAS. Thus far, it's mostly been taxpayers that have been footing the bill. From our calculations, and this number is probably pretty low, Minnesota has spent over $48 million on PFAS cleanup. But as you heard from the previous speaker, that number is just going to keep going up and up and up. So what's happening in 2024? This is the map of states that either have introduced or are anticipated to introduce policies to regulate PFAS. Right now, we have 21 states who are trying to address the use of PFAS, including 16 states that are seeking broader PFAS bans. When I say broader PFAS bans, I'm really talking about policies that would ban PFAS in a number of different product categories, or would take the approach that Minnesota took with Amara's Law last year that bans the use of all currently unavoidable uses of PFAS. 10 states are looking to ban PFAS from firefighting foam and personal protective equipment. And Maryland and Virginia are looking at the industrial discharges of PFAS. Virginia, I believe the bill is on the governor's desk right now. What it would do is monitor wastewater facilities, and any abnormally high level of PFAS would then be investigated. And Maryland is using its authority under the Clean Water Act to regulate industrial discharges of PFAS. As you spoke about, there is some infrastructure funding for PFAS. The federal bipartisan infrastructure bill allocated $10 billion to states for PFAS remediation. All of the states are doing this differently. I just looked up a few examples here. Pennsylvania placed their funding into this PennBEST grant program, where localities can apply for cleanup funds. North Carolina received $230 million in grants. But I will say, you know, one district alone is spending $30 million of that $230 million grant to build a new treatment facility. So as was said earlier, this is not a cheap prospect, and likely this $10 billion is just going to be nowhere near enough. Interestingly, California is expanding monitoring, but they're also investing in developing new treatment techniques and trying to find ways to treat PFAS for cheaper and faster. So that work is really nascent. And so, there's not a lot to report on that, but we definitely need, more investigation of treatment techniques, and we definitely need more investigation of what to do with filters once they have been spent. Because, as I said, there's just not enough information on what to do with PFAS and how to get rid of it. So finally, I'll just end by saying, you know, cleanup is great, and I think everybody's really excited about the notion of cleaning up drinking water and getting PFAS out of drinking water. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's even harder to do unless you turn off the tap. So Minnesota has been a leader in this, as I said earlier. passing of the MARS law, which bans all uses of PFAS unless the MPCA determines that the use of PFAS is currently unavoidable, meaning it's necessary for health or safety or the functioning of society. We are seeing other states starting to follow suit. California just introduced similar legislation. Colorado did as well, and other states are working on similar legislation to try to emulate what Minnesota has already done. As I've said, we've seen a number of product bans, but the more we look for PFAS in water, the more we find the same is true of looking for PFAS in products. So I don't think a lot of people anticipated that PFAS was used in deodorant until that study came out today. I've recently learned that PFAS is used in some car washes. So the more we look for PFAS in products, the more we find. And so keeping up with the product bans is going to be really difficult for states to do. States are also looking at disclosure policies similar to what is in Minnesota's MARS law. Maine has a disclosure policy, and other states have introduced policies to require disclosure of PFAS and products to the state. And some states are introducing measures on accountability. The state of Vermont was the first and only state, I believe, to pass a law on requiring medical monitoring for those living near polluting facilities. And they have introduced but have not yet passed strict liability for PFAS manufacturers. Right now, that strict liability really isn't there. But in order to be able to hold those who cause the problem accountable, that might be what's needed. So that is a very quick overview of what is happening in the states. I'm going to go ahead and stop my screen share, and I can take questions. Take your questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question, Ms. Salter, is there a part of Minnesota where there is a higher concentration of PFAS? I mean, if you'd answer that, please.
Yeah. So,
Ms. Salter.
I don't know that I'm the one who can answer that question. I've not done a lot of deep dives into Minnesota and what's actually happening in the current areas. So I think probably the MPCA would be a better one to answer that question because I just don't have that information right now.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Salter. Maybe then in a more general sense, you can answer, or is it less prevalent in rural areas? What about the where we have a lot of wells? Is it more prevalent there?
So,
Ms. Salter?
Yeah, I can't speak to Minnesota specifically, but I will say the more that we look for PFAS, the more that we find. And so it's certainly going to be prevalent next to disposal facilities or manufacturing facilities that use PFAS in their manufacturing, but it does travel, and it travels in groundwater. And other states that have tested wells have found PFAS in wells. So it's not just a metro problem. It's not a rural problem. It's really everywhere. As I said, there's more than 3,000 contaminated sites across the country. The previous speaker spoke about a few of the places where there is a lot of PFAS contamination, but we are seeing PFAS in private wells. We're seeing it, you know, in groundwater. So it's kind of an everywhere problem, unfortunately.
Great, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And to our testifier, you mentioned that in North Carolina, they're taking steps with their wastewater infrastructure to create new facilities. And I'm curious what those treatment facilities, what the comparison is between what is previously in place at those facilities versus what's been upgraded and filtering and what is being done differently.
Yeah, so facility that I spoke about is Fayetteville Works, and that is located next to a Chemours facility that has been polluting the Cape Fear River with Gen X, which is a type of PFAS, and so they have a really high level of PFAS in their area. Again, I can't really speak to the exact treatment technology. I can speak to my colleagues in North Carolina and try to get you that answer. I don't have the specifications on exactly what they are doing. I just know that they are upgrading it, and that upgrade is costing $30 million.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And just one more question. You know, one of the things that we're really grappling with here in Minnesota and up in our neck of the woods is just our landfill situation. And I saw in Minnesota, the MPCA found that there's PFAS in over 59 of our landfills and over 41 of our counties in the groundwater. So I'm just curious if there's, you mentioned that there's no real scalable technology. that would destroy it. And so I'm just curious, like, if you're seeing emerging technologies or what other states are doing in terms of landfills, do you try to filter and capture the PFAS, or do you just let it be what's sort of the better option at this point?
Ms. Alder.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I am not seeing a lot of the states trying to address PFAS contamination from landfills, unfortunately. And you're absolutely right. PFAS is leaching out of landfills because it's in consumer products, and it leaches out of consumer products and into groundwater. And so, we're really, as much as we know about PFAS and the dangers of PFAS, we really are at the beginning of this journey of trying to remediate PFAS in all different kinds of media. And so right now the focus has really been on drinking water systems, but there's not been a lot of focus from what I've seen on how to clean groundwater and how to clean PFAS from landfills. Some landfills are lined, but not all are, and that lining ultimately sometimes fails. So I do think some investment does need to be made in looking at treatment technologies and looking at how to prevent PFAS leaching from landfills into groundwater. That work just hasn't really been done yet, for the most part, because we are still trying to find out where it is and where it's coming from. As I said, the more we look for PFAS, the more we find, not just in our drinking water systems, but in products. And this problem has been in the works for over 70 years, and we're right now about 7 years into trying to fix the problem, and we just haven't gotten to that point yet, unfortunately.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Representative Lee. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair. And Ms. Salter, so I just wanted to focus a little bit more around infrastructure. Can you talk about to what extent other states are funding infrastructure beyond just relying on the federal government through the bipartisan infrastructure bill?
Ms. Salter.
Yeah, thanks for that. So I am not seeing a lot of states investing in infrastructure per se beyond the bipartisan infrastructure bill. States are spending money to try to clean up PFAS. They're spending money on drinking water, but on, massive infrastructure investments like the ones that we're talking about where you're upgrading facilities, other than installing filters in key drinking water areas, we're not seeing a lot of that. And a lot of it is just because states are, they may not be in the financial position to do so. And so this money from the federal government has given them the ability to do some infrastructure updates. But as the previous speaker said, $10 billion spread over 50 states and, countless counties doesn't really go very far in the long run. So, so that's why you see a lot of AGs who are filing litigation to try to recoup some of those costs. But again, we haven't really seen a lot of new infrastructure being built beyond trying to install filters and clean up PFAS where they can.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, so, Ms. Alter, I think you mentioned Colorado in one of your presentation, and in my brief review of what's going on, my understanding is that Colorado have a fee that they're collecting that could be used for infrastructure or for PFAS remediation, and to what extent can you talk about that,
Ms. Alter?
Yeah, thank you for that. I should have mentioned that. So Colorado placed a fee on oil and gas operations to fund PFAS treatment technologies. And so that was done a couple of years ago. I want to say it was in 2021 that they passed that fee on oil and gas. And it was a fee that sunset, that will sunset, I think, after 10 years. And it goes into this PFAS remediation fund. It's being used for cleanup. It's being used to install filters at this point. And so this is kind of their way of approaching accountability because ultimately, the oil and gas industry does use a lot of PFAS. And so they did place a fee on barrels. I think it was a fee on barrels of oil that come into the state. And so, again, I can't speak to specifics of exactly what Colorado is doing. My understanding is that it's really just being used, again, to install filters and to clean up where they can.
Thank you. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, the numbers that were talked about a little bit ago regarding the landfills that are closed in Minnesota, there's actually 110 of them that are being monitored. Of them, 98 have leachate consistent with PFAS. So in Minnesota, we have a plan. It's called the
MPCA's PFAS blueprint. There's three different legs to the stool. One is to mitigate the loss, one is to monitor. We did the mitigation last year by reducing or slowing that tap. We still have to monitor, and there's still that cleanup. That's the third leg of the stool. That cleanup cost is a very expensive cost, and I would just, for all of us, you know, that were at the legislature, I would say that our constituents really shouldn't be the ones that bear the brunt when we talk about the cleanup costs, because we have 101 landfills we're being monitored for it now. It's in all of our blood. It's a problem that all of our communities that we represent have to also address as well, and I look to them as good partners in this and not people that should be held accountable so much as that they're not the ones producing this as well. They're the ones that have to process it out of their wastewater treatment plants and get that water back where it needs to go in Minnesota flowing. And so, you know, I see a variety of challenges ahead in the landscape here in Minnesota. Our cities and counties, our landfills, all of those are going to be challenged. But I still think at the end of the day, it's not our responsibility to pay for that stuff. I think it's the producers, the ones who have made billions and billions and billions of dollars off of the health impacts that all of us are feeling across the state. They've known since 1950 that this stuff can bioaccumulate in a human body. And so I think it's something that we really need to make a good on when we talk about what our constituents should or should not be on the hook for, what our cities should or should not be on the hook for.
I think following up, it's really a polluter pays model. You know, we have the producers of PFAS and the variety of chemistry in the PFAS family, but we also have people who use PFAS to make things that we may be wearing or using, things we don't even know it's being used in. And what is the cost for that cleanup? I was struck on the, Ms. Salter, on the moving of the material. I just think of what happens if a city who's got this sludge that's from the filters and it's being shipped to Ohio and the semi goes off the road or the train goes off the road. What happens to this sludge? Where's the liability? So we have this whole system of moving filtered material out and around away from us, and that cost is being borne by the public. And so we've all been on these tours, and we've heard from our communities about, well, we just need to, you know, pay for this particular cleanup. The testimony we've heard earlier is that the settlements aren't going to cover it, and the federal government's not going to cover it through the Inflation Reduction Act or the IIJA. They may help, but it's not. And this will require an extremely large wallet if the state is going to pick it up, and that's one we don't have. Ms. Salter, is there any, you know, this interstate transport, you know, I'm assuming that commerce is, you know, the Interstate Commerce Clause is there, but what protections are there for people in terms of moving of this sludge material around in terms of transportation?
That's a really good question, and I don't know that I have the resources to really answer that right now beyond not many. You know, there is the Interstate Commerce Clause, you know, but I'm reminded of the disaster in East Palestine where vinyl chloride spilled, and, you know, there was a report that came out that showed that there's a lot of vinyl chloride that's being moved across the country, but it's not just vinyl chloride, it's a number of different chemicals and, you know, contaminated sludge like this, and we just haven't really grappled with the fact that, you know, we have toxic material that's moving through this country all the time, and communities are at risk. And so beyond, you know, a lawsuit, there's really not a lot of a lot of protection. And those lawsuits, as you've heard, are very long. They're very slow, and often they don't end up with the result that's necessary. So, you know, if I may be so bold as to say that we need investment in treatment technologies as soon as possible. We need investment in finding ways to destroy PFAS as soon as possible. As Representative Brand said, Minnesota has been a global leader in trying to prevent more PFAS exposure with the MARA's law. That is going to take some time to settle in and to be implemented. But Minnesota has a chance to really unfortunately, should be a global leader again to find some new treatment technologies. And I realize that funding is not necessarily readily available, but to be able to be a global leader on PFAS, as you have been, to invest in treatment technologies, to invest in PFAS destruction technologies, would be a boon, not just for Minnesotans, but for the rest of the country.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chairs. Yesterday, I was privileged to be in a meeting with Resource Recovery over at the Capitol in room 316, and the discussion table went around, and one of the points that Xcel Energy, there's a plant in Red Wing that burns garbage. They have successfully burned the PFAS at 1,000 degrees centigrade. That they came out yesterday public with it. I don't know, they haven't officially done a rollout, but I feel compelled to talk about it because I heard it. I can't prove it. I just know that they were very confident, 99.9%. They were burning. It's about 1,800 degrees. And when I brought up what we're doing in St. Louis County, trying to get capital investment money to build a to take all the landfills, the old landfills, and put them in a concentrated area to get the PFAS out of the ground there, put it in a area, and then we can manage those PFAS. My question to them was, can we burn just the PFAS, or does it have to be sprinkled amongst the garbage to burn it to get to eradicate them? And they didn't know right now. They know that they can successfully take my shirt, which I was wearing that had PFAS in it, and I'm like, who? You know, but he said they are doing that now. And it's new technology that's coming out. So I think we're going in the right direction. I like Representative Brand, think it's something we need to get on right now. In the sense that we know that it's in our landfills, our old landfills. We know it's going through our water system. If we can get what we're trying to do on the Iron Range, take these things and put them into a concentrated area to concentrate the PFAS, if we can find a way to manage them once we get them out of the environment, that's going to help us make the decisions to go forward. So I think there's technology out there. I don't know how much money we have to spend on to use that technology, but I'm more concerned about getting the PFAS out of the ground right now so that they're not radicals.
Ms. Salter, any response?
Yes, so that is a new, as you said, you just heard about it yesterday, and this is something new, so I've not really had a chance to investigate it. I know that traditional incineration does not destroy PFAS. I think some of the challenges with incineration in general is that while PFAS may be able to be destroyed, there may be a number of other harmful chemicals that are released in that process. Incineration generally is not really the best answer for the environment writ large or the communities that are living next to it. So the pilot treatment technologies that I discussed earlier were really very novel approaches to PFAS that did not include incineration. So something like certain kinds of bacteria that may be able to eat it or other types of technologies that don't include incineration. So it may be good to look at I'd be interested to see that report and to confer with my scientists to see what they think about it. But ultimately, I think incineration might be something that should be avoided just for not just because we're not looking to just destroy PFAS, but there may be a number of unintended consequences that can come with incineration.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. One of the questions that was asked, so what is the byproduct of that? And they believe that they're catching all of it. The stack was still clean on the outside, you know, when they're measuring the pollutants. So, again, I'm not even going to claim to be part of an expert. It's just what I heard, and it's 99.99% that they're getting out of the environment. they could go to 99.999999, but they don't have the technology to measure that far. So that's what we were told yesterday. Thank you. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franson, and then we'll move on to the next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to Ms. Seltzer, just a question here. I'm looking on a website from American Chemistry Council, PFAS, critical to renewable energy. We know that recycling of wind turbines is a relatively newer concept. Is she even on?
She's on.
Oh, okay. As a relatively newer concept, companies are coming up with innovative ways to use the turbines. However, we do have thousands and thousands of turbines across this country that have been buried in landfills. My question is, has there been any water testing in those areas and or soil testing to see how much of that is leaking into our water supply?
Ms. Alder.
Thank you for that question. I unfortunately don't have enough information on that. I haven't seen anything specific, but again, I don't purport to know everything that's happening in the world of PFAS. What I can say, though, that is, you know, in regard to the website that you mentioned, I don't think we need to choose either or when it comes to climate or toxicity. And I think that that's a false choice that's being presented to us by those who continue to make and to use PFAS, saying that we need PFAS in order to address our climate challenges. I don't think that that is true. There are a number of different alternatives that can be used in where PFAS is currently being used. And if those technologies, you know, may not be up to scale or may not be ready, I don't think we should be giving them a pass because they might be useful in some climate applications. Certainly, I think the quest for safer alternatives, even when PFAS is used in a low carbon you know, heat pump or in a wind turbine, alternatives either are available or should be made available so that we don't have to make that false choice between climate and public health.
Representative Franson. We'll move to the next presentation. Thank you, Ms. Seltzer. This is a Michigan perspective on PFAS. Abigail Hendershot, Executive Director of the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team and the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. So that's the Action Response Team for the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. Welcome via Zoom.
All right. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Proceed.
Okay. Excellent. Let me go ahead and share my screen then. All right. And I'm happy to share the slides with you after we are done here so that you can, and let me just put it into presentation mode. There we go. All right. I'm assuming you can see my screen all right?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So thank you today for having me and inviting me to be part of this discussion on PFAS. My name is Abby Hendershot. I'm the Executive Director for the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, what we call MPART, here in the state of Michigan. I'm just going to run through real basics of what MPART is, our collaboration structure, because it really plays into the discussion on funding and looking forward. And I will just mention that as in my role, I've been very closely working with your Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on a wide variety of PFAS topics. So we've got a lot of familiarity. So in Michigan, in 2017, MPART was actually started as an executive directive. We realized at that point that PFAS played a direct risk to the public health of the state. And so MPART was created to address that risk. So it is actually now been made as an enduring body under an executive order by Governor Whitmer. This is a one-of-a-kind, unique multi-agency approach. So we've got seven different departments that I help to coordinate on all things PFAS. It helps to coordinate the state's strategy on PFAS, and it leads to that coordination not only for state government, but also local and federal responses to PFAS in the state of Michigan. So our coordination structure looks like this. You don't have to know to even see the slides. Just know that MPART body itself, there's only like four of us that actually are considered to be part of MPART. Everybody else that I'm going to talk about in all the work that we have done are about 400 different staff that have some piece or part of the PFAS work that we're doing. They're all embedded in the departments. And so most of the work that I'm going to talk about here is actually done in our departments around PFAS. So MPART does a really good job, and the reason my job is really about coordination and collaboration. MPART doesn't actually set policies. Those are done within the departments, but we help to coordinate all of the strategies around PFAS. So obviously, MDOT is our Department of Transportation. They have all the airports. And so obviously PFAS is a big deal for airports, our Fish and Wildlife with DNR, Department of Agriculture with MDARD, our commercial food supply is a big deal. We put local public health in there because they are usually our boots on the ground for talking about public health. Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has all of our military sites. Department of Health and Human Services, obviously, is our health partners. Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy. And then LARA houses our state fire marshals. So everybody's got a little piece at the table in this structure. Because it has, we have my position as leading the team has really leveraged all of the resources that Michigan has put into the PFAS effort to really make Michigan one of the leaders around PFAS. We've really done most of this work that I'm going to talk about here in the last since the end of 2017. So our approach to PFAS has been, we're gonna use the science. We're gonna make sure we get the data to try to understand the sites. We're making sure that we protect public health through all of our investigations, protecting on the side of extreme caution, and then we're identifying those sites and reducing those sources. I'm gonna talk about that a little bit. A lot of source control has gone on. We've been able to identify where we've got industries actually leaking into our wastewater treatment plants, so the wastewater treatment plants don't have to actually put on treatment. We're making sure the industries that are discharging are actually putting on those treatments instead of the wastewater treatment plants. And where we can identify a responsible party, we are trying to use the law, as you guys are as well, to require actions to reduce those concentrations of PFAS. Everybody's heard and seen the PFAS cycle. I don't really have to go through this too much with you guys because I think you've talked about it already today. But obviously, a lot of our infrastructure work is around wastewater treatment plants. What we've done in Michigan is kind of turn that, and we've done a lot of sampling of wastewater treatment plants, sampling of drinking water plants. And so we can tell where which of those plants are having issues, and then we work with them to identify those sources that are getting into their wastewater treatment plants. So most of our wastewater treatment plants are not actually adapting any kind of treatment at their plants for PFAS. They're actually cutting off those sources upstream, and those industries are putting on the treatment, which is where we think that it should be done. That includes our landfills. A lot of our landfills are working on leachate treatment, and we've done a lot of biosolids sampling in the state of Michigan, and so we've seen those biosolids concentrations come down over time to the point now where we don't think we've got issues with biosolids in Michigan, the current biosolids, of course, because those concentrations have come down so much through addressing the sources, right at their locations instead of later at the wastewater treatment plants. Obviously, all of this works to protect public health and make sure that that our taxpayers aren't having to pay for things that really should be taken care of with the industries. So what this means in Michigan is since 2017, when we started doing this work, we've identified 278 different PFAS sites. Those are sites that have groundwater contamination above our state criteria and are a source of PFAS. They're either a landfill. We're going to talk about the different types here in a second, but they are on our website. We've also done at least 2,000 samples of surface water. All of our public water supplies are sampled on a routine basis. They're all required by the state of Michigan and the implementation of our MCLs. And then we've been doing thousands and thousands of fish samples. And all of that data is on our GIS system. So if you're interested, you can click on any of those points and see the information there. As I said, Michigan does have standards. We do have our own MCLs and our own groundwater cleanup criteria, which is the green box here for seven different compounds in the state of Michigan. We set MCLs back in 2020 when it was clear that we were not going to get federal standards very quickly. Still don't have federal standards, as you know. And so these are both are enforceable for both municipal systems and for those sites where they've got groundwater groundwater plumes that are above criteria. We can ask them to clean up to these standards. We also have surface water standards. So if we've got, you know, direct discharges into surface water, they have to be able to meet these standards, especially if they are, if that surface water, being the Great Lakes state, we have a lot of our communities that take water right out of the lakes for drinking water source. And so if somebody's discharging near one of those sources, they would have to meet these lower standards that is protective for human health. The types of sites that we've identified, we've gone through and prioritized our landfills. We have probably 250 solid waste landfills that we know of, but there are thousands of little township dumps that are unlined, uncapped, and not monitored that potentially all have PFAS as well. The landfills here you'll see in red make up the biggest piece of this pie. They aren't necessarily the highest concentrations, though. I will mention that when it comes to highest concentrations of PFAS that we find, it is usually from the plating facilities and or the chemical facilities. So those are going to have the highest concentrations. They just don't make up as big of a piece of this pie. Airports, obviously, almost all of our airports that have any kind of history with firefighting foam have PFAS contamination. Our military sites for the same reason. Wastewater treatment plants, we have a car wash, a school. Those are all less of a concentrated source. They do have exceedances, but they're not a very high concentration sources. Paper manufacturing, refineries, tanneries. Tanneries can be very high concentration sources. We just don't have as many of them. And then hazardous waste and power stations. So let's talk about funding. That's what you guys specifically wanted to know from this request to Michigan, is how did we fund our work? And I will say, as I was going back and trying to put this presentation together for you, a lot of the funds, the seed money, so to speak, in 2017 came as direct appropriations from the state legislature. They were very generous in recognizing the immediate public health concern. And so we had funds that were being spent directly out of state budgets, as well as general funds, remediation funds, and direct appropriations that came. Once we got things rolling, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the things that we were doing. Once we got those things rolling in 2017, 18, 19, then, you know, we came into some of the American Rescue Plan funds, the ARPA funds, the bipartisan infrastructure legislation, the bill funds, and there was emerging contaminants, the EC emerging contaminant funds under bill that was available, and EPA's now got some emerging contaminants and small disadvantaged community funds that we're also using. For loans and grants, obviously, we were going and using our drinking water state revolving funds and our clean water state revolving funds. And then we did direct appropriations. We have a fund called C2R2, and I'll talk about here in the next slide, that we did take some state dollars and some federal dollars and made that work for a number of communities. So when we started in 2017, and it was really the end of 2017 that we established MPART, and then in January of the next year got our first set of cleanup criteria on the books that were enforceable. In FY18, we started sampling all of our public water supplies. We needed to know what we had going on. So we started sampling public water supplies as phase one. We started sampling 95 of our wastewater treatment plants and testing biosolids. We started a pickup and collection of AFFF program. But all of that was done with state funds because we just didn't, you know, there were no federal funds at that point and we knew it needed to be done. FY19, we continued doing statewide public water sampling our landfills, starting to sample some of our hazardous waste sites. We started doing a few drinking water SRF loans that were given out to four different communities at that point. But about FY20, we started doing a fund that we called our Consolidation and Contamination Risk Reduction, so affectionately named C2R2, which was a $25 million of direct appropriation from the legislature, plus later on, I think in FY22, we ended up adding in another $18 million from the American Rescue Plan funds for PFAS. That ultimately funded municipal water extensions for 13 different communities that were affected by PFAS. So that was a huge start of trying to get a good inventory of those communities that were affected by PFAS and who was gonna need what, which communities were gonna have a future need for PFAS infrastructure or PFAS municipal water extensions because of the PFAS contamination being found in their groundwater. We continued on with doing AFFF pickup and from fire stations, we were still doing a lot of fish and deer sampling. So a lot of, you know, the ongoing state investment was still there, but we started to add in a lot of this federal funds as well. So for FY21, again, same things that we were always doing, continuing on with public water investigations, public health sites, or identifying sites in all of our different categories. But on top of that, then we added in about six different drinking water infrastructure loans and grants, about $16.9 million in drinking water SRF funds. We had one loan specifically to a community for $1.48 through a drinking water SRF. And then we did a state direct appropriation for the airports. So we gave grants. We had a $4 million pot of money that was a direct appropriation so that the airports, all 19, 20 of them, could apply for about $300,000 apiece to start doing investigation work at the airports to understand, you know, where was the contamination on their site? Was it leaving the site? Was there any drinking water wells at risk? We had gone and done proactive sampling around most of those airports to make sure that nobody was drinking the contamination because we did have a few instances of that in the state. But then this additional money was to help the airports continue on with that investigation work. FY22, we continue on with doing, using more of the C2R2 funds, the finishing up the ARPA funds. We had general funds that were awarded for some PFAS work, and that was all totaling $29 million. And then FY23, we had, and I believe these were drinking water, or it was all being run through the drinking water program of $28.8 million. For another three or four different communities that are getting infrastructure funds. And we've got a long list. I think we're gonna spend all of our bill emerging contaminant funds for FY24 and 25. We're expecting the next 2 years to get some additional funds through the bill emerging contaminants. And we've got money set aside. Let me go, I'm getting ahead of myself. So we've got money set aside here from our EPA emerging contaminants, small disadvantaged community grants. Michigan applied for that funding. It's a 5 years worth of funding. So years one and two came and we ended up with $38 million. So we're using that for helping out a couple of communities with some pretty big projects, and then doing some investigation funding of, or investigation of some particular areas of smaller and disadvantaged communities where not everybody in the community is hooked up to municipal water, and we think there's probably PFAS sources in their area. So we're going and sampling drinking water wells and then going to get those people hooked up to municipal water so that the cities are, the small and disadvantaged communities are taken care of. So we're looking for opportunities like that where we can take that funding and start using it for some of our communities around the state. There are is at least one community, they got an EPA grant or for agricultural investigations. We know there's another community that got a USDA rural development loan for municipal water infrastructure work. And I know they've got a water and waste disposal loan and grant program as well. So we're continuing to work on those. This is just a screenshot of those, the emerging contaminants, small and disadvantaged communities grants through EPA, and then the bioaccumulation plan uptake for agricultural sites. I think it's important to be holistic in our approach because this isn't just about drinking water plants or just about landfills or just about wastewater plants. We've got sites out there that are all kinds of different shapes and sizes when it comes. We usually think about cleanup and contamination sites being around industries or being around, you know, large cities. That is not necessarily going to be the case. And it could be in our rural communities that really will not have a drinking water source or be able to ever afford their own drinking water plant. So we've got to understand what the broad implications that are of that. And so we're trying to do that in Michigan. I will just put a quick blurb up here about our website. We have a ton of information on our website if you want more information. And we put out a fiscal year fast facts every year. It doesn't have the kind of information you guys were asking for the funding, but it is a pretty good overview of every year of what we accomplished in the last fiscal year. So we've been doing that for the last 5 years. So there's information out on site, on online, if you wanted to take a look at that. And we've got information on resources for residents. So for Gretchen, who was just talking, I will just point out to her that we probably got her website on here. Our resources for residents has a link for people to be able to search for PFAS-free products. And we're using websites like hers to direct people to those resources that are out there online that actually do the research around what's a PFAS-free product. So ton of information there. And I think I'm ready for questions if you guys are ready to ask.
Thank you, Director.
Unless you want me to go back.
Members, any questions? I do want to note that we will have 7 minutes since the Environment Committee will have to transition to their committee hearing time. Chair Hansen.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has Michigan done any work looking at the synergistic effect of PFAS found in water or air along with other contaminants or, let's say, nitrates or pesticides or other lead, any other type of contaminant has there been any research on the health side of impacts on synergy of these various contaminants?
Director.
Yeah, no, we have not done any, I've not seen any research like that on the synergistic effects of other contaminants. What we are looking at is just the basics of the synergistic effects of the total PFAS loading, because often, you know, we talk about individual substances, but often PFAS comes as a mixture. As we know with firefighting foam, it's not just one compound. So there is research going on that front. It's not being done within Michigan, but we are watching a lot of what DOD research is being. DOD sponsors a ton of research, and so we're watching a lot of that to see what the toxicity of mixtures, they call it, for PFAS is going to yield, because I do think there's going to be some additional information on that front.
Thank you, Director. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. And Director, really appreciate your covering rural communities and then also tribal communities up there in the presentation. I'm really interested in the interaction between tribal governments. I see on this map they're not specifically listed, the 12 tribal nations in Michigan, but just checking and seeing they're a part of your working group with the governments, and wondering if you can talk about that interaction of the tribal nations, but then also the funding with perhaps the small and disadvantaged communities. We know that tribal nations are impacted with our lifeways, our resources, and cultural activities and our traditional foods, but we are so often left behind in the federal research that's been done in the evaluation. You know, EPA, there's a lot of data that shows that tribal nations have been less studied and evaluated and monitored. And so if you could just speak to the remediation and then that relationship with tribes would be really helpful.
Director.
Yes. For the tribes, I will say that tribes are invited to all of our, we have, for every new site that we add to our MPART website, we do a local officials calls. And so tribes are always invited. They don't always participate. Where we do get a lot of participation is with our fish monitoring, obviously. They're very interested and get regular downloads from us on our fish monitoring and any kind of information in and around their tribal areas that they're concerned about. So we do have regular touch points with them. We do have a tribal coordinator within our department who regularly gets involved, and then I've been to a couple of their meetings as well. So I would say it's not as robust of a conversation as I would like to have, but I think it's more from the research side on their side of being having people to be able to attend the meetings and getting the interaction. As far as the funding, I think we've been doing some research that helps benefit them, but we've not done any collaborative research necessarily with the tribes. But there is quite a bit, I know, in the fish and wildlife arena. I'm seeing a lot of information from EPA and from different tribal nations on work that's being done in those arenas. But MPART hasn't had, you know, a lot to do with those pieces of it. Did that answer all your questions?
Representative Kozlowski, quick follow-up, and then Representative Ving, and then we'll be done.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lee and Director. And I think this just echoes, reinforces how important it is that we provide those supports in that capacity for whether it's disadvantaged communities or tribal nations to participate and make sure that we're mitigating this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Ving, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this quick. Director, if I'm just looking at the funding that you guys have. I'm wondering if you guys are spending on anything related within agriculture or if there's grants within that.
Director.
Whoops. Can you say that again? I got a little blurbed on my, or a little
Yeah, that's
wasn't
okay.
Clear to me.
So my question is, I was just looking at the funding that you guys have spent on PFAS and wondering if there's any in agriculture and if there's any spending in grants in that too.
Director.
Yes, we are. The agricultural piece is pretty big to us. We have spent money within the departments investigating a couple of different farms in our state. And so there has just recently been a grant awarded from our Department of Agriculture to Michigan State University to do some agricultural studies on one of the contaminated farms to look at crop uptake, look at, you know, the overall toxicity and see if there's any kind of remediation that might be able to be developed around sequestration or stabilization of PFAS in soils. And so that work has started, and we haven't gotten very far into it, but yeah, definitely funds have been used, not federal funds. This is all, again, state funds. And so state of Michigan's put in a lot of money, of our own money, in the PFAS effort. We don't have a PFAS manufacturer in the state, and we don't have any fees that are necessarily being leveraged against any of the, you know, PFAS manufacturers or PFAS users. So we've been doing it from direct appropriations and hoping to get it back in other ways.
Thank you, Director. And Chair Vang, I encourage you to look about bringing some of these testifiers to your committee, too, so that we can have a more in-depth conversation around your piece. Members, and I just want to say thank you all for coming by for the joint hearing and for all of our testifiers from the AG's office and from our two national counterparts. With that, at this point, the Capital Investment Committee of this joint hearing will be adjourned, and then I will turn it over to Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee will recess and will reconvene at 3:45 p.m. in Room 10 of the State Office Building. Thank you. We are in recess. I call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy Committee back to order. A quorum is present. Representative Scraba, have you read the minutes?
I did, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scraba moves the minutes for February 21st, 2024. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Ayes have it. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First up, and as I mentioned before the meeting started, we have four bills today. We're going to have the two Lee bills and then the Ryer bill and then the Hansen bill. We do have session, so we do not have much capacity to move beyond our timeline. So House File 3579, we have slated from about 3:45 to about 4:20. So Representative Lee, would you move that House File 3579 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Lee, I believe you had a DE3 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the DE3 amendment. And so what the amendment does, I try to take some feedback from the MPCA to scope the bill to cover facilities being major facility and facility with a state permit under Minnesota rules, and also to look at performance tests for facilities that are in EJ areas, and also just some of the other requirements that are under subdivision 4 that I could go through more thoroughly when I go over my bill, Mr. Chair.
Is there any discussion to the DE3 amendment? Representative Lee moves the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The DE3 amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 3579. Later after my presentation, you will be hearing from community members. And Chair and members, I'm really bringing this bill forward as a continuation of the discussion that we have, I believe, back in 2021 or so with Representative Wozlawick around the water gremlin situation. And I think that, you know, over the years, for those that have been here with me in my time here, really brought forth issues that deals with some of our major polluters. Three examples that I will discuss a little bit today is resolving around Northern Meadows that was in my district, water gremlin that impacted Chair Fisher's district, and then, you know, most recently with the Smith Foundry. And so I think the recurring issue for me and a lot of the community members that will be up here today is that we don't really have any consistency in ensuring compliance and enforcement with our air emission limits. Just an example, Northern Meadows, you know, from publicly available data from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, they first received their state permit in 1998 and had a major amendment in 2012. But their first air quality full on-site evaluation was not until 2003, so 5 years after they received the first permit. And then their second air quality full on-site evaluation was in 2013, 10 years after the first inspection. And as you may recall from my time here, the state entered into a consent decree with Northern Metals in 2017 for over $2 million. And so I think that's just an example of why we need more consistency and, you know, really having inspections. And then, you know, talking about Water and Gremlin, they received a state permit in 2000 and three major amendments since then, 2002, 2006, and 2023. Their first air quality full on-site evaluation was in 2004. The next one was in 2012. As you recall, too, the state entered into a stipulation agreement with Water and Gremlin in 2019 for over $4.5 million. It is, you know, since this agreement that there has been inspections in 2020, 22, and 23. And I do want to move on, and then, you know, most recently with Smith Foundry. And, you know, with the issue of Smith Foundry, they first obtained the state permit in 1992, and they did not have the first evaluation until 2018. And then again in November of last year, and, you know, for all of you, as you may have seen in the media, it wasn't the Pollution Control Agency, but actually the U.S. federal EPA that, you know, issued a notice of violation for Smith Foundry, alleging they're releasing air pollutions at a level beyond their permit. And so I think that's why I'm bringing this bill forward, for us to have a discussion on how could we really look at having more compliance with our air permits. And so to the bill, the bill requires each air quality permit issued to a covered facility to have a protocol for determining compliance through physical measurements and the frequency with which the covered facility must employ each method. The protocol must be designed to minimize the length of time between physical measurements of each pollutant emitted by the facility. Subdivision 3 of the bill requires a covered facility to maintain records of parameters that serve as an indirect measure of the covered facility air's emission, must require the facility to transmit the records to the agency no less than monthly. Mr. Chair, members, the intent here is to provide the MPCA with emissions information so that its compliance and enforcement staff can make full use of it when assessing compliance with permit requirements. And this is in line with what was recovered or recommended in the Office of the Legislature report around Water Gremlin. And so I just wanted to note that. And then Division 4, the performance test schedule are required for covered facilities that are located in or within 1 mile of an environmental justice area that emits a toxic air pollutant or a pollutant identified as a pollutant of high concern that does not measure the major facilities or the covered facilities emissions of the pollutants. And then performance tests are also required for covered facilities subject to the paragraph A clause 2, and they're also required for a covered facility that exceeds their emissions limit in a permit. And then also, you know, for those that have changed their equipment, it's required for that too. And we saw that was discovered under the Water Gremlin issue too. And so with that, Mr. Chair, open to questions or to public testimony first.
Members, any questions for Representative Charlie? Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions and then, you know, also some comments. Representative Lee, this is the third rewrite on this, and this is something that has been bouncing around for a while. I see there's no Senate author again. Every time this bill comes up, we're scratching our heads trying to figure out, well, what's going to be the magic sauce for it to be successful this go around. I'm not sure that we're there, considering, like I said, for example, the lack of a Senate author. In this edition, I'm still struggling to figure out what facilities this bill would apply to. And maybe you can help narrow that for us and give me a better idea, because you mentioned a few folks that are of concern to you, but who else is going to be affected? I'm worried about other small businesses. You may not intend to potentially be impacted by this language, but it just isn't clear to me.
Charlie.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. So the compliance determination protocol applies to covered facilities as defined in on line 1.8,
which are major facilities and facilities that have state air permits. And the MPCA is here if you want to ask specifically, you know, what facilities those are. And like I mentioned, the performance test schedule applies to those cover facilities that meet the criteria of A, B, and C, and D in Subdivision 4 of the D Amendment.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Lee, just to help myself and anybody maybe watching at home, are we talking about a body shop, an auto body shop? They have a cover facility potentially? I don't know. Representative Lee.
Charlie.
Oh, thank you, Chair. So the intent is for us to cover the facilities that are covered under that definition, and quite possibly, I'm not a staff at the MPCA. I can't tell you who will be covered for that, and if you want to know directly, Mr. Chair, I believe MPCA is here that can answer that specifically.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson? Welcome. If you could state your name for the committee.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We're currently working to pull up our data and list some specific facilities. If you're interested later on in the hearing, Representative Heintzman and Mr. Chair. But what I can say is we have, I believe, close to 300 Part 70 federal Clean Air Act permits that would be covered by this, that would be considered major source facilities. And then under our state permits, there would be about 120 facilities that have a state individual permit.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if that necessarily answers the question for the body shop necessarily, but I'll just move on to another question since MPCA is here. It'd be good to know how they feel about the bill. Do they support the bill, neutral, where are they at?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have some prepared testimony that I'm happy to provide to the committee. If you'd like to take that now, I'm happy to do that. Otherwise, we can take it in order as you've specified.
I think since you're already here, sure. We might as well start, but 2 minutes. Proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Want to thank Representative Lee for engaging us in this early. We haven't finished our review of the specific DE language, but want to just acknowledge that there were some high-level feedback that we provided, and really want to thank him for including, you know, attempting to scope the bill here a little bit. So appreciate that work and happy to continue to work together moving forward. We'll say that as written, the MPCA still has some concerns with the bill as amended. Just on the top level here, definitions in the bill are a little bit different from where they currently exist in statute and in our rules. So this could create a situation where we're, for example, the major facility definition, we would call a major source facility a certain type of Part 70 federal Clean Air Act permit, as I referenced earlier. However, that is based on a potential to emit that the federal U.S. EPA has a specific definition for. That definition of potential to emit is different in this bill. And also, then the major facility definition is different within this bill than those other definitions. So this could create a lack of transparency for the agency's process, where we have additional facilities that qualify as major facilities, but then don't have a major source permit or a state. So there's some clearing up there that could happen, and would appreciate working with the author on that. We also, in the compliance determination protocols, in order for permittees to comply with the protocol, they would have to either install a continuous emission monitoring system, a complete stack testing, or install ambient or portable air monitors at their facility. Depending on the facility, this may not be physically, technically possible. There's a lot in the bill, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I'd like to get a little bit more of this on the record, but would just say generally there's some clarifications where the agencies need to understand what we're supposed to do with the records that we're getting from facilities. If we're meant to review those, that would require a lot of additional staff time. Would just also want to clarify that the SEMS are not, the continuous emissions monitoring systems are not available for all pollutants. Only a very small subset of pollutants can be measured with those systems. It's similar for stack tests. They're only available for a certain subset of pollutants. And so if we're looking at all the pollutants of facilities, sometimes there's over 100,000 different pollutants that the agency tracks. So some of those could be stack tests for, some of those could not be stack tests for. And depending on engineering considerations, some facilities do not have stacks to test.
I would note the bill is being laid over.
Absolutely.
So it's not moving out of the...
And I was just going to end here, Mr. Chair, with just saying we do welcome this type of effort to increase the amount of information that we're getting at the agency. It's why we welcome the air toxics reporting bill that Chair Lee also authored last year. So this is a good goal. We'd like to just continue to work with the author on some of the specifics. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So I want to make sure we get the testimony in. Yeah. So we're going to go to the testifiers, and then we'll go back to questions. So first up, Stacy Gurian Sherman, JD, Climate Justice Committee. And we'll do, like in previous meetings, 2 minutes, and I'll tap the gavel when we hit the 2 minutes. Thank you.
I'm prepared to testify on 671 and 3579. Which one would you like me to start with?
3579.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. I am Stacy Gurian Sherman. I'm a constituent of Representative Sensor Murrah in 63A. I live in the Corcoran neighborhood in South Minneapolis. I live less than a mile from the Smith Foundry in our East Phillips neighborhood, which didn't go through a permit process for 31 years. I'm here to testify strongly in support of 3579 that would ensure and strengthen compliance with air emission limits. I recently walked to the Smith Foundry to leaflet the workers there to encourage them to go to a health forum that was being sponsored by our Minneapolis City Council member, Jason Chavez, in Ward 9. I was struck by what I saw on some of the workers, soot on their face. And it brought me back to the early 1960s when I would go on field trips to the behemoth Ford Rouge River plant, which had big furnaces and coke ovens. And we would go up on the catwalks, and we would come home with soot all over us, our faces and our clothes. We went once a year. Smith Foundry workers are there every day. The children and the staff at Securlio Child Care Center, a quarter mile away, are there every day. And, of course, the residents of East Phillips experience it 24/7. In the late 1960s, those school field trips were called off for obvious reasons. But as the Henry Ford Museum points out, there was a growing awareness of the environment. The auto industry matured. Government and manufacturers alike became aware that black smoke had other implications. I'm struck that over 60 years later, this awareness still isn't actualized for neighborhoods like mine and for neighborhoods like in North Minneapolis that deal with the HERC waste and energy facility and in St. Paul's Frogtown dealing with the St. Paul Brass and Aluminum Foundry. All of these are examples of facilities that are benefiting, profiting from inconsistent and ineffective permitting and monitoring. At the same time, they're operating and they're harming people. They're dying of chronic illnesses. They're burying their children, their adults, and their elders. The compliance determination protocol in this bill will bring about stricter control. If I could just finish my sentence, thank you. And would require more consistent controls. This obviously goes beyond awareness of what black smoke is to dealing with it. And I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Roxanne O'Brien, community member for environmental justice. Welcome.
Thank you. I would like to just speak on behalf of both these bills, but I don't know which one is up right now. I'm sorry.
3579.
The testing. Okay. So I'm here today because I personally had experience in North Minneapolis, as you all may probably know. from all the times we testify about Northern Metals and that experience in our communities. They weren't responsive to they did not want to be tested. They didn't want to be held accountable. They even lied on their emissions. So I want to just say that our communities really paid the price for years. We knew what was going on, but we didn't really have ways to, like, test and be sure about what was going on there. So this would be helpful to other communities as well, our community still, because I think, again, it's about accountability and, like, how are we holding each other accountable in our society? And then, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we still feel bad that Northern Metal still was allowed to operate, and Becker, because 3 months later after they left North Minneapolis, they caught on fire for 5 days and used over 500 million gallons of water to put out that fire and all the emergency services there. So it's just good to hold people accountable and make sure that you're testing and not allowing these things to continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and then Andrea Lovell, Minnesota Environmental Justice Table after that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for allowing me to make a couple of brief comments on House File 3579. Just to kind of put in perspective of what we're talking about, the impact of this bill is statewide and will impact certain things. Representative Heintzman had asked entities such as cities, schools, hospitals, and colleges and universities. And so the concern also is with the testing requirements that we already have a backlog right now at some of the testing firms in the state, and will this add to that? Also, the financial implications for project proposers as well as for the state agencies, as you heard from Mr. Johnson, and also some of the testing protocols also of the requirements that were listed in the bill are not all fully established, Mr. Chairman. Also like to point to the legislature's action last year on air toxic reporting and air toxic emissions, as well as the establishment of environmental justice areas and cumulative impacts within those environmental justice areas. Those are currently undergoing rulemaking right now at the state agency, and I think that we should probably see how that process plays out before moving forward. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Andrea Lovell, Minnesota Environmental Justice Table, and then Tom Dicklich, Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Andrea Lovell, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Justice Table. I'm testifying in support of House File 3579, and I'd like to thank Representative Fu Lee for bringing forward his bills today to address some of the current gaps in our permitting law. I spent my childhood bouncing between environmental justice communities in the Twin Cities. I lived in East Phillips, Frogtown, Payne Phelan, and other neighborhoods in North and South Minneapolis, now identified by the city as green zones. Like my neighbors, I have a battery of health consequences associated with the risks of living in a community overburdened by pollution. Every time we hear about a polluting facility in our community violating a permit, I and other community members feel a mix of validation and outrage. Validation because we have cold, hard data to back up our experiences, and outrage because we shouldn't have needed that validation in order to be heard by our regulators and lawmakers. When the most recent example of this emerged in November with the news that the EPA found violations at Smith Foundry, frustrated community members asked regulators, how didn't you know earlier? And how did you not have how do you still not have data about their air pollution emissions? And the answer is pretty simple and also pretty alarming. The permit doesn't require them to. This bill requires regular measurement and regular reporting of emissions of facilities with major air permits and is a partial fix of the problems we are having with permitted facilities in environmental justice areas. If this bill was law earlier, we might have been able to catch and address Smith Foundry's violations sooner. And hopefully this bill will catch other violations sooner so we can address them sooner. If we need the validation of data to back up our lived experiences, we need to be requiring the data. I urge you to support House File 3579. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom Dicklich, Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, then Aaron Clems, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tom Biklich, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. We represent over 70,000 union construction workers here in Minnesota. There's nothing more important to our affiliate unions and our members than safety. We want and demand safe workplaces and safe neighborhoods to live in. So we appreciate the efforts of Representative Lee and others to make sure industrial facilities are living within the emissions limits allowed in their permits. However, we believe that it is essential that efforts to do this do not add an unreasonable amount of paperwork, cost, or administrative burden to businesses, and that they don't slow down the already long process it takes for a business to get an air permit from the PCA. We want to have strict standards for emissions and to make this a place where businesses can have certainty and predictability in our permitting processes so we can continue to recruit businesses to locate and expand here in Minnesota. We have been concerned in the past couple of years with the high-profile projects deciding to either locate outside of Minnesota or moving their operations somewhere with permitting processes that are more certain and predictable than they are here. Both the livelihoods of our members and the vitality of our communities hang in the balance of such business decisions. We do, however, support the next bill Rep. Lee will present to this committee. Companies that break the rules should be held accountable. But again, we caution that adding the additional burden of House File 3579 would add to an already cumbersome permitting process is not the right move. Thanks.
Thank you. Aaron Clems, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and members. My name is Aaron Clems from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. In the interest of moving this along, I submitted written testimony as well for both of these bills, and I look forward to answering any questions you might have about it. Thank you so much.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak for or against House File 3579? Former Representative Clark, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members for the opportunity to be back among old friends and also some many new people too. I want to start by thanking Chair Lee for bringing this bill forward. I served with some of you earlier, and I want to point back way back to 2008 when we passed a pretty important bill that said that in environmental justice neighborhoods, which are basically communities that have majority people of color and low income people of color and Native Americans living in those areas, that have disproportionate toxic exposures. It's just a fact that in Minnesota, we can put that on a map. And I brought the map with me today, and I'm going to just pass out.
And just,
if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark, if you can state the name for the record, I'm going to allow handing out, but I cannot allow a prop. So I think we have rules on that. So if you can hand out the material, but and then what I'm going to provide is that the map be set up in the back of the room, but
sure.
We do.
The map is just a document that we used 16 years ago that demonstrated the disparities. And I just want to say that the importance of this bill is to enforce existing law and the laws that are coming on the books and the rules that are coming in the books from Representative Lee's bill that he passed last year. And there's just such an urgent need to have compliance. Several other people have mentioned the Smith Foundry, which is, I live two blocks from the Smith Foundry in East Phillips, Minnesota, and Minneapolis, and there's just no doubt that that particular facility has violated so many parts of environmental law that it took the U.S. EPA, the federal government, to come in and do a surprise visit to document what we had already been feeling as residents. You could smell, people were sick, so much asthma. Childhood lead poisoning is an epidemic, as is asthma, heart disease, all these things that are related to these kinds of particulates that come out of those emissions and several other facilities. So, Mr. Chairman, I won't go into all of that again, but I know you're on a time crunch and you need to go to the floor. So recognizing that, I'll just say, I'd be happy to provide more detailed information on those disparities and the kind of human costs that are addressed really by what this bill would bring forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak for or against the bill? And then I believe I Representative Finke, were you seeking to be recognized before the questions? Or, okay. So now,
no, that's anytime.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And to Chair Lee, thank you for bringing the bill forward. And I appreciate your continued work on this. Where this gets to be very critical is that there are some times where you have people who have violations out there and they don't realize it because they're doing math. They're not doing actual tests. And so what this would do is make sure that we're catching people in that kind of situation. But more importantly, we have bad, there are some bad actors that are out there, and the only way you're going to catch them is to be able to have a process like this established. And I'll use the example of Water Gremlin, is where in that instance, it was something that was not caught until too late. But not only did they find this problem, they found out they were mishandling lead in the process. 25% of the kids that were tested that, 25% of the children of parents who worked at that facility who were tested had lead poisoning in their blood because of how bad they were handling the lead in that facility. So a lot of times this acts as an indicator of not only what's happening wrong within the environment, but other things that are wrong that are making our environment dangerous. Each of these families that worked there, all of their cars had to be cleaned, some of them multiple times because the lead contamination was so bad. In addition, the lead was found in their homes and they had to have their homes cleaned. And this was only in the people, in the homes of the people that allowed it. In some of the homes, it probably occurred, but the people were immigrant population, were here legally, but were afraid to say anything because they were afraid to lose their job. I'm sure there are houses out there or apartments out there that are contaminated by lead that were never found, and they're exposing other people to it. And this is the problem if we don't have a good system set up. Thank you for bringing the bill. We need to get something like this moved forward.
The bill is being laid over. Is any other questions? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, for bringing your bill. Yeah, I mean, Rep. Fisher said this, but I just want to get it on the record that this is one of those moments as a representative where, like, I'm pretty stunned to learn what we allow, and I think most Minnesotans would be pretty shocked to learn that we don't have a mechanism in place to do this basic thing. We just allow polluters to pollute. We say, you can do this much pollution. And they say, we're going to pollute way more than that. And then we say, we don't have anything to do about that. Like, how is that possibly the state of law in Minnesota? It's just shocking to me. When you add on to that how racist the data is that we're looking at here, there's no other word for it. 34% of Minnesotans have high-risk polluted areas, 91% for communities of color. That's racism. Like, we can pretend like we're talking about small business or whatever, but the numbers are just the numbers. I'm just shocked by how obviously wrong what we're doing is. So I don't even have a question. It's just, like, stunning to me. We need to fix it. Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you. Closing, Mr. Chair, I really appreciate the conversation. You know, like you mentioned, you know, it is being laid over, and to, I think, one of the other members' questions, this is a third version before you because I'm trying to work with anybody who's interested in making sure that this is a program that will work for the entire state of Minnesota. And so just in closing for this piece, I just wanted to point back to one of the findings that I mentioned before in the OLA. And I quote from the report, at a minimum, the MPCA should meet federal standards for inspection of emissions facilities. There should not have been an 8-year gap between MPCA's Water Gremlin inspections. A federal standard call for inspection of this type of facility is no less than once every 5 years. Bring it back to Smith Foundry as to why we're, you know, bringing this back forward. They first got their permit in 1992, and the first evaluation was in 2018. And I think you heard it from our committee members, community members that's here already, you know, 16 years in between inspections or whatnot. I don't think that's well, no, more than 16 years. Apologize for my math. I just don't think that's acceptable, and I really appreciate the feedback and the conversation. Let's work to make this work for everybody in the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 3579, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Lee to House File 671, and we are allocating time till 4:45 for this. Would you like to move House File 671 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee, I believe you have a D3 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The D3 amendments went through and really put in some amounts, increase some of the penalty fees, and I could cover why I justify that in putting those figures and just real briefly before I go into my remarks. A lot of these numbers were enacted back in the 70s and 80s, and we haven't changed back then. And when you account for inflation, this is the number that we have for $2024. And so that's the reasoning behind that. And Mr. Chair, I urge your support for the DE3 amendment.
Is there any questions to the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The DE3 amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Like I mentioned in my remarks, the civil penalties amount in section 15071 as it relates to water, air, land, and land pollution were first established in 1973, and no more than $10,000 per day in violation, and in 1983 for hazardous waste violation at no more than $25,000 per day of violation. And these have not been increase since then, and so that's why I'm proposing to increase these amounts. The administrative penalty section in 116.072 was first enacted in 1987, and the amount was up to $10,000, and then it was increased in 2014 to $20,000. And so if we were to adjust it for inflation to $224, that's why we have the amount that's included in there. Just wanted to add that there's also a provision to increase the penalty of repeat offenders to at least 10% higher of the penalty amount assessed for a violation within the previous 36 months. And I think this goes to the issues that I saw in my district, with regards to Northern Meadows. They were found to have, violated some of our pollution laws, and then went through the whole process, and that's how we ended up at 2017 with a consent decree. And so just trying to get to that point. Section 2 is where we increase the administrative penalty from $20,000 to $25,000. And then Section 3 of the bill requires for repeated or serious violation, the commissioner or county board must issue an order with a penalty that would not be forgiven. And so just real quickly to this point of the bill, this goes in line with one of the findings from the OLA again for water gremlin. And I would just acknowledge what they said. The OLA said, we think it is reasonable that MPCA has latitude to make judgment about how best to bring a company into compliance. In this case, the MPCA thought that a 2001 schedule of compliance could get water gremlin to comply with its permit going forward. But looking back, it is worth noting that water gremlin started its long history of permit non-compliance as soon as its initial 2000 air quality permit was issued, and it received no financial penalties for non-compliance until the 2019 stipulation agreement. If MPCA had issued penalties for permit violation based on publicly available data from 2000 to 2002, perhaps this would have sent a stronger message to water gremlin, possibly affecting the company's compliance in subsequent years. And so, Mr. Chair, I'll just leave it at that for right now, and look forward to the discussions and public testimony.
Any questions for Representative Lee? I think we'll go to the testifiers, unless Representative Heinzman. We'll go to the testifiers. First up, Stacy Gurian Sherman, JD, Climate Justice Committee.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm Stacy Gurian Sherman. I live less than a mile from the Smith Foundry. I'm also a member of the Climate Justice Committee and a member of the Shut Smith Down Coalition. I'm here to testify strongly in support of this bill that would ensure real accountability for facilities that pollute by raising the penalty fees and not forgiving those penalty fees once they comply after they've been found to be in violation. I'm a mostly retired attorney, and I spent most of my life doing criminal defense and also did civil litigation. When my clients came in with suspended driver's licenses, they were subject to fines, and penalties in jail up to 6 months for each violation. Ignorance of the law and certainly willful defiance of the law was never a defense. They didn't get off from those fines and the other consequences just because they fixed the underlying problems of their licenses and got them renewed. The same must be true of foundries and factories that violate laws that are supposed to balance the profit-making ability of a company with ensuring the public safety and lack of harm to those who are right next to them. A good example is what Representative Lee brought up, which is Northern Irons in the east side of St. Paul. Over a 15-year period, they had five violations, five. And you know what happened during that 15 years? They got to continue to pollute. They got to continue to harm the community while they got to make profits. And each time they did that, somebody was getting harmed. They finally got a fine of total of $41,000. They paid it off, and they went on and fixed up their act. The problem is, what happens when you keep getting those fines and you keep accumulating them? 671 will go a long way to make sure that increased penalties will ensure that foundry owners feel it where it hurts the most, in their pocketbook, and take out a chunk of their profits. And facility owners will comply more quickly if they know that they can't keep dragging this on and then eventually get all of the fees waived. So I very much urge the passage of this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Roxanne O'Brien, community member for Environmental Justice.
Hi again. My name is Roxanne O'Brien, and I mean, I've been an advocate for at least maybe 11, 12 years on EJ now, and just from what I've seen, I mean, Northern Metals is just like a perfect example of why we have to become a little bit more stronger when we think about, or smarter, when we think about how we're going to keep communities safe. And I think what I notice is you know, people talk a lot about how businesses and corporations, like, they have all these costs that they are responsible for when they open up businesses, but nobody thinks about the costs that people pay with their lives for these businesses. And there's a lot of privileges given to these businesses with giving them permission to continue to operate based on the fact that they have jobs for people, right? Jobs for families. We all agree that everybody needs jobs, and nobody wants to take away jobs from families. But I think that the real honest truth is corporations, they don't want to be monitored because they are making up emissions on their papers. And then they also don't want, they don't want to be given fines at all. But I think, like someone else just said, it's important to like let them know that you're serious, because I think human beings are being held to high standards out here. Like, if you have a problem house on the block, it's a nuisance law, right, to like stop that. But there is like no laws to stop these facilities, and they're really given the benefit of the doubt. I want to say one other thing. I had actually called the police on Northern Metals one day just to kind of see, you know, if I could report this criminal activity. I said, you know, they have lied on their emissions nine times. That's nine felonies in 1 month that we caught. And the police came, and when I finally got the report back, the police actually said that I was kind of suspect, like that there was something wrong with me, and nobody ever investigated this place. So please, let's just, you know, let's just make it fair, way more fair, because I think corporations are already getting the benefit of the doubt and making all the money. Thank you.
Andrea Lovell, Minnesota Environmental Justice Table, then Aaron Clems, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. My name is Andrea Lovell, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Justice Table. On my way to the hearing this afternoon, I stopped at a vending machine, and I bought my Vice Addiction Diet Coke. I paid $1.25 for it, and I paused internally to complain at how expensive that is. I remember when I could only get this for 75 cents, but, you know, inflation. I paid $1.25, but honestly, the real cost is so much more than what I paid out of my wallet. Somewhere down the line, this can end up as waste. It will hopefully be recycled, but it could end up landfilled, incinerated, or shipped off to a poorer country where it will end up who knows where. Those are what we call externalized costs. It's a cost that we don't have to factor into the price of purchasing or producing something.
like the cost of pollution that taxpayers pay for cleanup. We've had a lot of recent externalized costs in the news, largely falling on environmental justice communities. However, it's all over the state. Last year, we learned about externalized costs of PFAS cleanup amounting to $14 to $28 billion. Environmental justice communities have been paying the externalized costs of the HERC incinerator for decades. We're learning about more externalized costs with the polluting facilities like Water Gremlin and Smith Foundry. We're all paying the externalized costs of climate change and the loss of biodiversity. To avoid the full brunt of externalized costs falling onto taxpayers, we have a few tools in our toolbox. One of those is for the Pollution Control Agency to collect fees when companies violate their permits. In other words, when companies externalize more of the costs than we allow them to by law. Just like the cost of my Diet Coke increasing in the price at the vending machine, the cost of cleaning up pollution goes up with inflation too. And that increased cost shouldn't land on taxpayers. It should land on companies who are in violation of their agreement. And that is simply what this bill does. I urge you to support House File 671.
Aaron Clems, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and then Tom Johnson, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Aaron Clems is fine. So Tom Johnson, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'll keep this really brief, Mr. Chair. Want to again thank the bill author for making us aware of this before it came to a hearing, so really appreciate the opportunity to work together. Really just want to highlight a few items for the committee and the author to consider. First of all, in the new penalty cap amounts, just want to flag that the ultimate penalty is decided by the court. And, you know, in our experience, that while the agency can bring forward a penalty amount and suggest a penalty amount, the court ultimately would decide under this first subdivision what the ultimate penalty amount is. So just, you know, we do not have a position on the amount of cap there. Would leave that to the legislature to decide, but just wanted to flag that it could, you know, ultimately be the same type of judgment from the court either way. The new paragraph B, we're just looking for some clarification starting on 1.16. That section, we do consider repeat violations, and just looking for some clarity from the author's intent on whether, you know, usually our repeat violations are for the same type of violation. If this type of subsequent violation could be under this language any type of violation, so it could potentially be a large, you know, significant violation where there's a large penalty and then a very small penalty like missing a submission deadline for a document that we're asking for, and that could still require an increased penalty of additional 10% higher per day, even though the violations are very different. So just wanted to flag that for the committee and the author. The changes to penalty amounts under Section 2, Subdivision 2, may be more impactful than the changes to the per-day caps. So for the committee's understanding, the last time this penalty cap was changed was about 10 years ago in 2014. The US EPA regularly updates their administrative penalty caps to adjust for inflation. And again, we'll leave the decision on the appropriate amounts to the legislature, but just flagging that this is an item that hasn't been updated in a while. Looking at the effective date of the DE, just want to again flag for the committee that this would affect all open enforcement cases by making it immediately effective. And that could reopen penalty calculation discussions that are ongoing for those open cases. It could lead to additional staff time and delays in resolving open cases. We might have to revise our internal process before moving forward on some of those open cases as well. And then finally, the change on line 3.17, of course, is a small change from may to must. but it does remove the agency's discretion regarding forgivable APOs. And it's important to the agency because the forgivable portion of a penalty does incentivize the completion of corrective actions in a timely manner. So that's the reason why we use that discretion. Again, leaving the decision up to the legislature, but just providing those bits of context for the committee. Again, happy to work with the author on this moving forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who to the author to answer some of those questions or reference them?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, for the intent, you know, regarding paragraph B, line 1.16, I think, you know, we, you know, just going back to the example of Water Gremlin, when the MPCA went in, you know, with one issue and they came out with another violations. And so I think I will leave this discretion to the commissioners, because if we go in and define specific type of violations, you know, we may miss other violations that we don't know that exists out there. And so that's, you know, the intent of me as the author for this piece. And I think, you know, if I miss some of the points, I apologize. I think, you know, just going back to the line of 3.17, you know, making that a requirement, as I have seen, or, you know, use the example, yes, we could give them discretion, but at the end of the day, you know, if people want to be a bad actor, they're going to be a bad actor. And so why don't we try something else, making a requirement that, you know, may not be forgiven.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to speak for or against the bill? Members, any questions? We've got Representative Edelson and then Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Lee. This is I very much support this bill. If it looks like it's 10 years ago, it sounds like it's a good time. I just had a question, and have we heard this bill before, by the way?
Chair Lee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, this is the first time that we have a public hearing on this bill.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. So it looks like the commissioner is going to set the amount of the penalty. Is that right? But then where does the funds go? Is it going to the state? Or I guess I'm from reading the first part, it looks like it's going to the state. So I guess, and what is the funds going to be used for?
Shirley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the funds will be going to the Environmental Fund. That's under the purview of this committee.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lee, I have similar questions about this bill as I had the last one. We recognize that there are bad actors that have taken advantage of low penalties, maybe would be one way to describe it. My concern is for small cities, potentially farms, small businesses. And there may be in 114C or in 116 some kind of a exclusionary statement of some kind, but I don't see it here in the language specifically, and if I missed it, I apologize. So maybe, Representative Lee, if you could help me understand or help show me that this bill wouldn't affect these small businesses or cities, that would be helpful.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that regarding that piece, you know, we are clear that if they violate Chapter 115, 116, or 114C under civil penalties, then I think that encompasses, you know, every entity. And I would just like to refer back to Mr. Johnson that we set these limits, but it is up to the judicial branch on how much they want to levy that penalty fee on those entities, whether that's a, you know, small community, small business, big business. That's up to the judicial branch, like what Mr. Johnson mentioned.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, if Mr. Johnson could address the question.
Looks like he's ready to.
Excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Tom Johnson, Government Relations, MPCA. So, yes, Chair Lee is correct that we would set this bill would set a new cap, but not necessarily determine what the ending penalty would be. So the agency could, when calculating the violations and documenting the violations, could, to the court, present a suggestion, but ultimately the court would decide what the final penalty would be.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So either to Mr. Johnson or Representative Lee, my concern continues to be that some folks that you, I'm assuming, wouldn't necessarily intend to be impacted by this, what in some of these examples is a pretty significant increase, sometimes seven times what it currently is, could be impacted quite negatively. And in earlier MPCA testimony, we're hearing that the opportunity could be taken away for those that may be incentivized by elimination of a penalty. And the goal here is, of course, to reduce pollution or entirely stop pollution. So, I mean, and for these folks in, you know, maybe a situation to resolve that situation. So I hope that there's some changes that could be made and some clarifications. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and, you know, to the committee and to that point, you know, we're not changing anything other than the fees. And like I mentioned, you know, we are adjusting it to inflation. And I was going to save this for my closing, but, you know, if we put this, you know, these current fees in 2024 into 1973 fee standards, you know, the Section 1, the limit of $10,000, that equates to $1,500. And, you know, as we know that with the cost for compliance equipment and whatnot, that's going to increase. And so if you're a business, it's cheaper to pay a $1,000 fee than to actually comply with your permit. And so just wanted to leave at that, that, you know, looking at the $10,000, you know, for 2024, if we were to count it to $1,973, it's only $1,500. And so that's why, you know, the increase in these fees, I'm not just getting it for anyone. I think for what I'm doing is to adjust it to inflation.
Members, any other questions? Was that your close?
Mr. Chair, I would just have a quick closing. You know, really appreciate the conversation. And, you know, I think that we have heard from community members who have been impacted. And I just want to, you know, to go back to that point. I think we could differ on whether we should increase fees or not. But I think I believe that the intent of having these, you know, penalties, or, you know, I would hope that all of us don't really want to levy these penalties on any businesses. But, you know, we have these in place so that, you know, we deter bad behaviors. And so, Mr. Chair and members, you know, if you're interested in working on this, I'm more than willing as we work through the process with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 671 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Next up, House File 3474, Representative Ryer, Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve. We were planning till 4:55. We're running about 5 minutes ahead of schedule. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Ahead of schedule is good. So I do have a DE amendment, Mr. Chair.
I will move that House File 3474 be re-referred to the Legacy Committee, and I will move the DE1 amendment that the author intends. To the amendment, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here. House File 3474, as amended, appropriates $4 million to the Reinvest in Minnesota, or RIM Reserve Program, and request funding from the Clean Water Fund. The funds would go to two purposes, $1 million to help us maintain existing RIM locations by conducting an assessment of wetland restoration structures needing repairs or replacements, and then $3 million directed to a 9-county area in southeastern Minnesota that's experiencing severe water quality issues. The intent of this appropriation is to obtain easements in areas that make groundwater particularly sensitive to contamination As you'll hear, this may include trout streams or dissolved bedrock, sinkholes, or sinking streams. As this is not a quick fix, this is an investment in the long-term well-being of the area's water supply. And it's an urgent need in that this is a particularly vulnerable area that needs our attention and support. Now I'd like to turn it over to Sheila Vanney, Assistant Director of the Minnesota Southwest Soil and Water Conservation District, to share more about how RIMS operate and explain more about how the funds would be used.
Just before that, we need to adopt the DE1 amendment. So any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The DE1 is adopted. To the bill as amended. Ms. Vian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Sheila Vanney, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation District. And I want to thank Representative Ryer for carrying this bill and for the DE amendment before you today. Just a bit of background on the Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve Easement Program. That is a voluntary conservation easement program that was established in law in 1986. And so the implementation of that program happens at the local level through soil and water conservation districts, doing outreach and marketing, helping enroll landowners in the easement program, and then turning it over to the state where the Board of Water and Soil Resources acquires the easement on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Wetland restorations that are done through this easement program by law need to be permanent easements. And of the approximately 7,700 easements currently in our inventory across the state, it's estimated that about more than half of them, about 3,000 of them, have a wetland restoration component. The structures installed as part of these wetland restorations have an expected lifespan of about 25 years. So the state has an interest in investing in preserving these assets to make sure that they continue to provide the expected ongoing public value. So this assessment that we're proposing be done through the Board of Water and Soil Resources and Soil and Water Districts would provide a more comprehensive picture of the health of those wetland structures, the designing and the engineering components that went into them, with a more thorough field inspection and, like I say, maybe more of an eye and towards the engineering aspects of them. On the second piece of this then relates to acquiring new easements, in particular in the southeast region that has karst landscape and is therefore more susceptible to nitrate contamination. As Representative Ryer noted, those nine counties would include Dodge, Fillmore, Goodhue, Houston, Maurer, Olmsted, Rice, Wabasha, and Winona counties. And the Board of Water and Soil Resources would then prioritize these easement funds to areas that have trout streams, dissolved bedrock, sinkholes, sinking streams, or other features that make that groundwater particularly susceptible to contamination. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, that's a quick overview of the bill as amended, and we would appreciate your support and consideration. And again, want to thank Representative Ryer for carrying the bill.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering if trying to recall if this was included in the Clean Water Council's recommendations, and I don't remember, and if not, maybe the bill author knows the reasoning for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to get back to you on that. I do not know the answer.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think in working as the chair of capital investment with the initial bill coming to us, I just wanted to put it in perspective that, you know, this upcoming year we're going to have a challenge with putting a capital budget together. Over $7 billion in requests, a lot of pressure from members on both sides of the aisles to fund local projects. And so, you know, with the forecast coming out tomorrow, I think that will really tell us, you know, what is our capacity within bonding. And so that's why I think this is appropriate for us to take a look at
other sources of funding as we move forward, and if it's limited, you know, in other sources, we reconsider in capital investment too, or other pots of money.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for coming back to me here. I just have a comment that I'd like to make after the response to my previous question, and then an additional question. And I just would point out that the Clean Water Council, as far as I know, has introduced a recommendation for the additional dollars that have become available. And it's concerning to me that this wasn't a part of that recommendation, at least that's to my understanding. My question, in addition to my comment, would be if this particular bill, like another one earlier heard today that didn't have a companion, do we expect this one to have a companion in the Senate? Hope, yeah, I got my information correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, yes, I do expect it to have a companion in the Senate.
Representative Heinzman.
No, nothing further. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else with any questions? I just should note for the record, this committee and the environment budget provided $3 million in cash last year for Reinvest in Minnesota as part of the one-time money budget. As Representative Lee noted, the bill has come to us with general obligation bonds. I think, Representative Heinzman, you're aware that with the Clean Water Council, there was a legal memo that had come from the Senate about some of the recommendations, some advice in terms of recommendations that the council did make. So as you know, it's up to the legislature to decide what those appropriations should be. And I think Representative Ryer has, this is going to Legacy Committee, and that'll be discussed there, as probably other bills will as well. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there are no other questions, I just ask for your support. Thank you.
I renew my motion that House File, look at it here, House File 3474 as amended be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. Turning the gavel over to Vice Chair Jordan.
Next on our agenda is House File 3874. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 3874 be re-referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee.
Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do not have an amendment. I think this is just the bill as it is. Members, this bill deals kind of with two parts. The first is increasing the penalty relating to buffer law violations. Believe it or not, it has been almost 9 years since the buffer law was passed. And so this would increase the penalty similar to what Representative Lee's bill had said to make it something consequential rather than the cost of doing business. And it provides that authority to the counties or the watershed districts who would know best what to do there. Secondly, the Lawns to Legumes program, we are now up to 23,000 potential participants. This would make their data private, not public. And so the bill is going to Judiciary Committee because of those purposes. We don't want all of those Minnesotans to be getting a lot of advertising directed to them with their data. So this would, like we do with many other people, make it not public information. So that is the bill, and I don't have any other testifiers. I believe there is someone here from Bowser who could describe the details if needed.
Yes, I have Dave Wyron from Bowser. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with any testimony you may have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is David Wyrens. I'm Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Just a few brief comments on House File 3874. Regarding the administrative penalty order language that's provided here, a couple of observations that we would make about that is that the changes that are proposed here will provide an additional tool to us as we are undertaking our enforcement work under the Riparian Protection Law. The other thing it does as well is it provides a consistency. We've had this authority for administrative penalty orders for the Wetland Conservation Act for about 15 years now, and this would make the authority identical for both of those programs. So there certainly is some value in regards to that. As we look at the laws of legumes provision in Section 3, there's a little more context I think that's helpful for the committee. And we do support this language regarding the change in application of the Data Practices Act. It's important to recognize that when we make grants, it's typically to local governments and non-governmental or organizations. The information that they provide as part of our granting processes are public data as well. And these individual citizens that are applying for Lawns and Legumes funds, they're treated identically to local governments and NGOs in terms of their contact information, their addresses, and that sort of information. We think this is something, a change that will help provide some additional protection to those individuals and keeping some of that data as non-public information. All other information about the Lawns and Legumes program would be public, but just trying to make sure that individuals are not providing unnecessary information through a public data request. So we do support that language in House File 3874.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Now we will go to questions from members. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a number of questions. So, Representative Hansen, I'm going to start with what I thought I heard you say was a 9-year gap between the penalties that were set previous to the penalties that you're adjusting. And if I have that wrong, I apologize. I just wanted to clarify based on your testimony if that's what we're looking at. Because if that is the case, it would be a 20 times increase from $500 to $10,000. Maybe the time frame is different, but if you could address either the time frame and then also the significant increase from what would be, I think, as you mentioned earlier, cost of doing business versus $10,000. Hopefully there could be something in the middle.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I was unclear, I was trying to make the point, it's been 9 years since the buffer law was passed, and these penalties were in that. I am not saying it's an inflationary increase for those 9 years. I think as Mr. Wyrens had noted, this brings the penalties into line with the Wetland Conservation Act. As has been the case with, the discussion with the Pollution Control Agency, the discretion is with the agency. Often there is a notice of violation or there's a series of steps that go on, so you have a situation where it has to be quite egregious, that discretion is there. And providing that to the county and the watershed district, as I mentioned, the APO authority, they're gonna know that area best. So that discretion is not the county or that watershed district. And as you know, we have provided money to the counties and the watershed districts for enforcement. This tool will make sure that there's a penalty side that is greater than what it has been and is equivalent to the Wetland Conservation Act.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the other item that I wanted to address was the Lawns to Legumes program, which we've debated on the floor many times, and there may be some examples or some data showing that the Lawns to Legumes program may not be as widely liked or appreciated, and some cities rejecting that program entirely. What's the reason for making some of this information classified as private?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Heintzman, as I mentioned, I don't want it to be I don't want the participants to be getting advertisements. I don't want them to be having services sold to them. I don't want to have political mailers going to them. I want to make sure that that data is protected as other some of the other government program participants are.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have, as I just mentioned, a few questions about the bill and concerns, so I think I will leave it at that and appreciate the answers and would also ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Any further discussion on the bill? Representative Hansen, would you like to make any closing comments?
Members, again, as was testified to, this is bringing the penalty authority equivalent to the Wetland Conservation Act as what it has been for 15 years, and it provides protection to those folks who participated in the Lawns to Legumes program so that they will not be pestered for participating.
Thank you. Mr. O'Neill, will you take the roll?
Chair Hansen.
Aye.
Chair Hansen, aye. Vice Chair Jordan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Jordan, aye. Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Heintzman, no. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Brand.
Brand, aye.
Representative Brand, aye. Representative Burkle.
Burkle, no.
Representative Burkle, no. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Finke. Representative Finke, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Representative Fisher, aye. Representative Gilman.
No.
Representative Gilman, no. Representative Jacob.
No.
Representative Jacob, no. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lee, aye. Representative Liz Lagarde, excused. Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Purcell, aye. Representative Scraba.
Scraba, no.
Representative Scraba, no. Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Madam Vice Chair, the ayes are 9, the nays are 6, and 1 excused.
The vote of 9-6. House File 3874 is being re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee.
Madam Chair, someone has left their glasses and their phone up here, so I don't know.
Just note for those in the audience, you've got some good stuff down at the desk. Please retrieve it. Any other announcements? With that, we are adjourned.